Security Ledger podcasts reach an audience of thousands of information technology and information security professionals each week. If that's an audience that you'd like to reach, think about becoming a Security Ledger podcast sponsor. To find out more about sponsoring our podcast, point your web browser to securityledger.com/sales. This is the Security Ledger Podcast, and I'm Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's episode of the podcast, number 153, cities across the United States are struggling with ransomware infections. Now the U.S. Conference of Mayors is taking a hard stand. This week, they unanimously adopted a resolution not to pay any more ransomware hackers. But is that the right move? In our second segment, we are joined by Andrew Dolan of the Multi-State Information Sharing and Analysis Center, or MSISAC, to talk about it. But first, the Department of Homeland Security on Tuesday warned hospitals about a serious and remotely exploitable security hole that's been found in two common anesthesia devices made by GE Healthcare. Department of Homeland Security issued an ICS medical advisory on Tuesday for the GE Estiva and the GE Aspire anesthesia machines, noting that software that runs on some of the devices could allow a remote attacker to connect to and remotely modify device configurations without first authenticating. That includes changing the composition of gases aspirated by the machines and silencing alarms. How did such a dangerous flaw escape the notice of the manufacturer? Well, we talk with the man who discovered the flaw this week, Elad Luz, the head of research at CyberMDX. He tells us that serious and potentially life-threatening security lapses like this aren't all that uncommon in medical devices.
So my name is Elad, and I'm the head of research at CyberMDX. As part of my job, I'm studying the network protocols of medical devices, usually to apply that knowledge to the system we're developing. Once in a while, we run into devices that have some security issues on their protocol. And when we run into such issues, we contact the vendor and we may start responsible disclosure process, which is what happened here. What we've discovered in this protocol is that it allows remotely changing certain settings with no authentication. And those settings are things like changing the gas composition. Perhaps this was allowed to have technicians come over and maybe calibrate the machine. You also are able to remotely change the date and time, and you can also remotely mute alarms. Usually hospitals use devices called terminal servers, which are used as bridges for connecting serial devices into standard networks. So eventually, if you would connect to that terminal server, you'll be able to talk straight to that serial device, in this case, the anesthesia device. More technically speaking, that terminal server is going to expose several TCP ports, and he's going to redirect whatever is going into those ports into the serial devices behind it.
So this is an add-on to the anesthesia devices that would be deployed alongside it and basically would help to connect it to the hospital network, let's say, and kind of mediate communications back and forth to the device itself.
Yes, correct. So if you want to have this device connected to the digital workflow in your hospital, that is the option.
And you said you, as an attacker, you would not need to authenticate at all to that terminal server in order to manage the device. Is that correct?
Yes. So by default, there are different vendors of terminal servers, but by default, no one would put any type of restriction on them. And for this case, perhaps, the hospital has no reason to suspect that this communication channel allows other things than just telemetry. So the original reason why hospitals would connect those devices is the telemetry.
Right, just being able to remotely monitor the behavior of the device, but not actually change its function.
Yes, correct. Just get traffic from the device out, not into the device.
But you were able to figure out that you could actually change a composition of the gases, suppress alarms, and so on. Those are features that were built into the device, you said, maybe as part of a kind of diagnostic or calibration or something like that, sort of a maintenance function built into it. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
But there was no additional security put around those features, such, obviously recognizing that they would pose a physical risk to a patient who might be connected to that machine.
Correct. So you would only have to know the right commands to be sent. This is, of course, a proprietary protocol.
Does the fault lie then with GE or with the terminal server vendor or both? Who where We always love to point our fingers and blame people, so who do we blame?
I don't like blaming people. I like fixing things.
Good attitude. I'm a
So,
journalist, so I just like blaming people.
yeah. So in this case, the terminal server vendor is unaware of what you're connecting. So I would say tens of thousands of different devices from different sectors and users that do serial type of communication, and you can use a terminal server with them. However, designing that anesthesia machine and deciding that those commands are allowed with no type of authentication, I think that a more secure approach could be taken here when designing the anesthesia.
These two machines from GE, the Estiva and the Aspire, and those are AES 7100 and 7900 models. This seems like a pretty simplistic type of a security problem. In other words, it's not complicated to understand what the risk is here or how an attacker could leverage it. Is it the case that this one just slipped notice by GE, or that they were aware of the ability to do this, but just kind of made the assumption that anybody who had deployed this would, of course, put, other security mechanisms in place to isolate it or require other types of authentication before accessing the anesthesia machine itself?
So I believe this is more of an awareness thing. So sometimes when a vendor develops a machine or a device, whatever, there are things like debug functions or calibration functions that are available and open. And when device reaches production, usually you're supposed to.
Turn them off, right?
Yeah, exactly. And perhaps this is the case here. For this protocol, there are several versions for the protocol that can be used with this device. So I can say that changing the gas composition was only allowed on the first version of the protocol. Later on, they turned off that functionality. However, they left out a command for requesting the device to speak at an earlier version of the protocol. I guess it was for backward compatibility. What you could actually do is the device is talking a newer version of the protocol. You could send it a command requesting to go back to an earlier version of the protocol, and then use the gas composition change command. So on the way, they were thinking about, well, this feature is unnecessary, let's block it, but they were probably not thinking it through.
You reached out to GE, and were they responsive to CyberMDX's report? And did they act in a way that seemed responsible and attentive to you?
So we contacted them and reported that, and they made the evaluations and tests. This process was led by the ICS cert, and eventually it did take a pretty long time to finish this process.
When did you first report it to them?
Around October last year.
So you guys do research on a lot of different medical devices, kind of what your company does. As you said, these terminal servers are pretty common, connecting medical devices to TCP/IP networks. Is this type of problem pretty common as well, that once you've connected it, that there is not proper security around key device functions in these medical devices? Or is this instance really an outlier?
Yeah, unfortunately, this is not an outlier. We often see this in medical devices, the lack of authentication and the ability to remote control features that should probably not have been able to be remote controlled.
Right. And GE, I know in their alert, made a point of saying, like, well, this is a device that really is meant to be an attended device and managed, you know, physically from the device itself. But of course, if that's the case, then these commands shouldn't have been remotely controllable. But you're saying that's actually not that uncommon, is it? Is that because of the what you said? You know, maybe these are design time or testing and validation features that were meant to be turned off and then are never turned off? Or are these remote management and control features being added as a convenience for hospitals and customers without maybe properly addressing the risks that they pose?
So it's both, but it's mostly the first one. So commands would be available, but the hospital wouldn't be supplied with software that utilizes those commands that perhaps are there for technicians, which also means the hospital is not aware that these things are possible.
Final question. So the CVSS score on this was 5.3. I'm guessing just because it's like a, you know, remote authentication issue. So in the big scheme of things, doesn't seem serious. But of course, the consequences here are physical in some cases. People could die. Did you take any issue with that? I sort of looked at that and said, I wonder if, because this is an anesthesia device, if maybe that CVSS score should have been higher than 5.3, given the potential kind of cyber physical consequences.
So that's a really great point you're bringing up here. The CVSS metric system, unfortunately, you can't do a one-size-fits-all in this matter, because I think it mostly fits the cases where you have an operating system and a software, and you're evaluating how vulnerable the software is within, a PC software or a mobile app or something like that. But when you have such of an embedded, dedicated device, okay, such as a critical one, such as medical devices, who has a specific purpose, like anesthesia, delivering drug gases, and you can manipulate or alter that sole functionality, that entire functionality of that device, personally, I would consider this a higher score vulnerability.
Sure.
However, in the technical aspects, okay,
yeah,
we don't have what's called a remote code execution. We can't install malware on this device or something. So this is not critical in technical means of compromising.
Right.
Yeah. But the ironic thing here is that if a hacker would compromise an anesthesia device, the worst thing you could think about, the worst thing you can do that I can think about is manipulating the gas composition, which is exactly what's done here.
Right. It's almost like there needs to be a different, either a new kind of criteria that feeds into that CVSS, or maybe just a whole different rating system that involves cyber physical risk.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree 100%.
You know, for hospitals or clinics that are out there that might be using this type of device, what's your recommendation for them to figure out if they've got this exposure on their network?
First of all, if they do use a terminal server, they're configurable, so they may have default passwords. So if they do, change them. Also, I would recommend to see how these terminal servers work. Are they listening for incoming connections? Are they initiating connections to other servers? Mm-hmm. Usually, the initiating approach is more secure. Also, can they have any sort of access control, or do you have any firewalls that you could at least restrict access only for the servers that are really required to do the communication with that device, that terminal server? We have monitoring solutions that's dedicated specifically for the healthcare sector. So we focus solely on the healthcare sector. And our solution sits on the network, and it listens to the traffic. And just from listening to the traffic, it can understand the context of the communication. So for this particular case, it would understand what is going on with the communication with this anesthesia device. And in case you are not, you don't have a patch for that medical device, in case you're afraid that perhaps the endpoint that is authorized to talk talk with it, has some malware in it, at least you could make sure that and monitor that the communication with that device is legit.
Elad, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, and I really appreciate it.
Oh, sure. Thank you so much for being interested.
Elad Luz is the head of research at the firm CyberMDX. Up next, the U.S. Conference of Mayors unanimously adopted a resolution this week not to pay any more ransomware hackers. That amid a nationwide epidemic of ransomware outbreaks on municipal networks. It's a laudable declaration, but is it smart? Recent cases like the ransomware infection that hit the city of Baltimore suggest that it may not be. Absent strong IT security controls and a robust backup and recovery practice, communities that are hit by ransomware may face a difficult and expensive road to recovery should they decide not to pay the ransom and tell ransomware criminal groups to take a hike. In our second segment this week, we're joined by Andrew Dolan. He's the Director of Stakeholder Engagement for the Multi-State ISAC, or MS-ISAC. Andrew tells us that ransomware is one of the most pressing challenges facing city and town governments these days. Ransomware gangs have become adept at distinguishing between secure and insecure government networks, and they even have a good grasp on the community's ability to pay, adjusting their ransom demands accordingly. In this conversation, we talk about what the MS-ISAC is seeing and how communities can best protect themselves from ransomware outbreaks.
My name is Andrew Dolan, and I am the Director of Stakeholder Engagement for the Multi-State Information Sharing and Analysis Center, as well as the Elections Infrastructure Information Sharing and Analysis Center, the MS and EI ISAC. So the Multi-State ISAC and the EI ISAC were set up by the Department of Homeland Security to provide cybersecurity assistance across a variety of different areas to the government sector. We specifically serve the state, local, territorial, and tribal government sectors, as well as the elections community across the entire country. Our membership is representative of approximately 85% of the U.S. population. We actually have sensors set up and active on every single state and territory in the country. So we have really unique insight as to the threats that are being faced on a day-to-day basis by the SLTT, and forgive me, that's another acronym I use. It's state, local, tribal, and territorial governments.
As you look across your membership, are these attacks really affecting both small towns and large cities? Are they clustered more around bigger targets, urban government networks, or is it a real kind of scattershot approach, targets of opportunity, regardless of the size of the community?
It is absolutely a target of opportunity. They're looking for that low-hanging fruit, and they're looking for opportunistic targets. But they very, very much know who they're going after. Obviously, when they went after the city of Atlanta and Baltimore, they were asking for a far greater ransom because they knew those cities were so large than they would if they went after, a small town in upstate New York. So they know who they're going after. They adjust their ransoms accordingly. But they're very much looking for folks who are running out-of-date software, not running antivirus, are not keeping up with patching and updating their servers, their operating systems, and even their content management system. A lot of times, this is what we see in terms of the attack vector, if you will. One of the other areas that we've also seen just recently is that folks are going after some of the open ports that what we have to try to really get in is telling people they need to close ports that aren't being used. One of these specific ones is port 3389 that allows for remote desktop protocol. Mm-hmm. This type of thing is absolutely an easy way that people have gotten in. But, I tell people all the time, you need IDS systems, you need antivirus, everything like that. And it's really a defense-in-depth approach. But the best thing you can do is make sure your staff is trained, you've got a regular patching cycle, that you keep backups. And the two huge things about backups is keeping them offline and really off your network and making sure that you're testing them. I can't tell you how many people we've had who have called to tell us that, hey, listen, we're just reporting this for situational awareness. We got hit by ransomware. Don't worry, we've got backups. And then they're calling us an hour later because they hadn't tested their backups in a year and a half, and the backups aren't valid. Something wasn't working right. They weren't, tested regularly. That's the one thing I tell everyone is that when it comes to ransomware, the best thing you can possibly do is keep your backups offline, off network, as well as make sure that you are testing them multiple times a year.
So you just sort of outlined some basic, good basic hygiene and also recovery aspects. So if you're not going to pay the ransom, you're going to have to make sure that you've got backups and working backups. So how is it that we end up with communities like, let's just take Baltimore, that was offered a $70,000 ransom, said no, and ended up with many, many times that in recovery costs? How do those decisions get made? And does ISAC have a role, or who is advising communities on saying, listen, you know, turning your back on the ransom offer may not be the best decision for you, given what we know about your IT environment and your preparation for this before the attack?
So one of the things that I can really kind of say is that in terms of who is advising these folks, it's usually the FBI, whether or not they're on retainer in terms of a contract with a private cybersecurity company that's providing services to that government. The ISAC is always happy to give advice, but you know, really what we're working on, primarily our role, the FBI is worried about catching the bad guys and going after them. And you know what, we're happy to cede that responsibility to them. Our role in this is we want to figure out how they got in and make sure that it can't happen again. It's something that we find right. So many times that a lot of these times the corrections aren't made and the folks are then exploited very soon after that. And again, I will say, these things make the news. These ransomware events are now in the news, they're in the media, and if you are willing to pay, and it's one of the things that I've heard FBI agents tell folks who they're working with on recovery, is that if you choose to pay, that is your own prerogative. They won't force you not to, but that it is going to be public knowledge that you paid. And if you are one of the organizations who are willing to pay the ransom and aren't going to try to recover on your own and go that way, you will be targeted more frequently.
The FBI's own guidance on this is a bit confusing. On the one hand, they say we never advise organizations to pay the ransom, but then they go on to say, you know, we understand that individual organizations more or less are going to, you know, make up their own mind and have to do what's in the best interest of the organization. So kind of a nod to the fact that, you know, organizations may not be able to have a hard set, you know, we never pay ransom position. And I'd be interested in your thought. I mean, is that confusing for a, you know, let's say a municipal government and IT department that are in the teeth of a ransomware attack to have this somewhat contradictory advice from the FBI saying never pay the ransom, but we understand sometimes you need to pay the ransom?
In terms of that contradiction, it's really their way of saying, listen, if it is our choice, we would tell you to never pay. But we spoke that they don't have backups that haven't been done for years and they're going to lose everything going back forever, how long, or, you know, God forbid it gets into a police department and their case files and, you know, they're going to have, you know, hundreds of cases that are awaiting trial with, and in those cases, while they still wouldn't recommend that we pay, you might not have a choice. You know, there might be, in terms of absolute business continuity, keeping your government up and running, if you haven't done your backups and you don't have good cyber hygiene and you're not kind of, you know, keeping an eye on the pulse of your own environment throughout the year, you might have no choice but to pay. Personally, I'm with the FBI in that, you know, you don't want to pay because you're going to be targeted more.
Right.
But at the same time, it is a contradiction in that you might not have a choice. You might have to pay to get yourself back online.
Right. And when you look at a community like Baltimore, where, you know, they, again, there was $70,000 ransom offer, but then the cleanup has cost, I think upwards of $18 million. You have to wonder, okay, well, you know, we pay the $70,000, we get targeted again. We're still not going to get anywhere near $18 million. So the cost of them to walk away from that has been substantial. And it's unclear as to, even if they were subsequently targeted, if they would be, you know, anywhere near as deep in the hole as they are. I guess the decision to not pay the ransom needs to be informed by a realistic estimate of what it's going to cost to recover. And my guess is that that's kind of where things break down, because communities maybe don't have a clear grasp on what the recovery costs are going to be. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. Well, my thoughts are that, you know, when it comes to this type of thing, a lot of the recovery costs and what they're doing, upgrading their systems, you know, moving to a new operating system across the entire environment, that's extremely pricey, and that's included in those recovery costs. But it's going to keep happening whether if they don't make these upgrades anyway. So there might be a lot of upfront cost when it comes to that, that equals, you know, when totaled up, it ends up being a lot more than that ransom might be off the bat. But at the same time, these are upgrades that have to be made if they're going to be protecting the personal and private information of your citizenship. And these are things that while the cost might come all up front and all at once, they should have been budgeted in kind of throughout the years. You know, you need to move off end-of-life systems, you know, Windows 7, that type of thing. You know, these are all coming to an end. And we need to make sure that we are running up-to-date systems. And many times, you know, it's factored into the recovery costs from ransomware. But these are things that, even if ransomware hadn't hit, should be in that budget for the next year or however many years out you're planning, depending on what operating system you're running and when it's going end of life.
So it turns into a kind of an occasion to do a system-wide refresh of your, you know, major platforms, I guess, and that gets pricey.
Yeah, and people think that, oh, God, this is just the recovery from ransomware. But it's, no, you know, these are upgrades that need to be made regardless. The ransomware might have been the factor that, you know, lit a fire under everybody to get them moving, but that was something that needed to be done either way.
It almost seems to me, and I've never been, you know, in the trenches in one of these cases, in one of these communities or organizations that have been hit by this, but it almost seems like there should be a rubric of saying, okay, you know, if you've been doing backups in the following fashion, as you said, you know, they're cloud-based and offline or local but offline, you know, you've been regularly testing to make sure that the backups are have integrity and are usable, you know, and all these other things that, you know, you have confidence that you've, you know, isolated and removed the ransomware outbreak or whatever. Then the rubric suggests you can go ahead and say no to the ransom and just do your restore. Whereas if you can't, you know, if the rubric indicates to you that, you know, you're not meeting many of these standards, then you should, you know, start looking at your, you know, opening a Bitcoin wallet and you know, moving past this incident. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like it should not be so difficult to figure out, okay, we're taking a really big chance here by not paying the ransom, and we don't have high confidence that we're going to be able to recover. So we should just go forward with the ransom versus, no, you know, we're very confident in our backup and remediation efforts, and so we're gonna go ahead and do it.
Yep, absolutely. And that's, honestly, that is one of my favorite calls to get. When somebody calls me up, tells me, hey, listen, we had a ransomware incident. We're just telling you this for situational awareness. We have tested offline, off-network backups. We're going to restore, and we're going to tell this guy to take a hike.
Yeah, that's a good day.
That's a great day.
I guess, you know, with the goal of, you know, preventing there from being any more victims, although I know that's impossible to do in the short run, what kind of guidance can multi-state ISAC or FBI or any of these other organizations give to these localities, these local communities that, you know, don't have huge IT teams, you know, might not have a very deep bench of IT expertise, to put them in a better place should a ransomware outbreak occur in their IT environment?
Well, obviously, all the basic cyber hygiene things that we've discussed, but also making sure that they're taking advantage of the free federal resources that are out there. You know, the Department of Homeland Security has an absolute wealth of resources outside of even what we provide in the ISACs. We make sure we don't double up. We all provide unique things. But these are, you know, things that a lot of people aren't even aware of. I laugh all the time. I go, you know what, we're great at making things to help each other, but, you know, there's, if you count special districts, you know, libraries, K-12 schools, there's 80 to 90,000 local governments around this country. And many of them, especially in schools, you know, rural police departments, law enforcement, they don't have this expertise on staff. You know, they don't have folks who are 100% every day working security. But one fantastic program that people can use to kind of get themselves in a better place is the Federal Virtual Training Environment. It's actually run by the Department of Homeland Security and has over 900 hours of free training that any government employee in the country can take advantage of on demand for free anytime they like.
Could we prevent there from being any more, I hate to pick on Baltimore because, again, Atlanta had the same situation, but they've become a poster child and maybe for good reason. But is there a way we could prevent any more bad outcomes like that where a community just makes the wrong call and you know and I know that paying the ransom doesn't necessarily guarantee them that they're going to get access to their systems back. But is there more we could do or MSISAC, the federal government, DHS, vendors to keep communities from making that good feeling but foolish decision?
We're never going to be able to stop it completely.
Yeah.
These things are going to continue to come after us. And, you know, a lot of times we catch them as they come through. But if somebody is really committed to getting someone, you know, if someone out there specifically decided that they were going to do nothing with the rest of the hours for the rest of the days they've got left on this earth other than target date, they're going to get me eventually.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things where the best thing that you can do is really do your due diligence. And for these folks, these out there, these attackers, this is a numbers game. If you can at least make it difficult on them, if you can make it not worth their time, they're going to move on to a different target. And that's one of the things that you've just got to be able to put yourself in the best position possible.
Sure.
We're never going to eliminate it completely.
Right.
We're, you know, as long as the internet is around, unless there is some huge groundbreaking updates made in the next few years, this is always going to be a threat. There's always going to be people out there looking to exploit others for their own gain. You know, it's one of those things where you just want to make it so that you are not the easiest target out there. You know, really the best thing we can do is our due diligence for the constituency of all of our governments is making sure that we're given the best effort possible.
Final question. I mean, given the centrality of the FBI and all this, would you like to see them come off of this doctrinaire position of, you know, we don't advise paying ransom and have something a little bit more nuanced for communities to help them say, well, for you, it might be you know, advisable to do it, but obviously, you know, with these caveats, you know, you might not get access back, you might become a target later on, but, you know, looking at your situation, it seems like the best advice. Would you like to see the FBI have a little bit more of a nuanced take on this or not?
Obviously they could always come up with a more nuanced take, but I believe that the message is and should remain the same. You know, they're never going to tell you to negotiate with criminals.
Yeah.
You know, that's who the FBI is.
Yeah.
They don't want you to do that. And these folks, even though, you know, they're nonviolent, they're somewhere in some other country, something else. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, you don't want to reward that bad behavior. The FBI is never going to say that. And we're never going to get rid of these folks completely.
Right.
But the best thing that we can do is make sure that we are at least trying to hold them responsible for their actions.
Andrew Dolan, Director of Stakeholder Engagement at the Multistate ISAC, MSISAC. Thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on Security Ledger Podcast.
Oh, it was my pleasure. We are always happy to help and help educate the sector and public about what we do and how they can better protect themselves.
Andrew Dolan is the Director of Stakeholder Engagement for the Multistate ISAC.